On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA.
I think that any work of art has to have a spirit, has to have a feeling in order to be really art. If it's alive, it's art. If it's static and dead, it's not.
Reflections on the Sheets Goldstein House from architect John Lautner and others coming up in the show. And ahead of this Sunday's Academy Awards, we'll talk to a nominated costume designer who's competing against herself. Before we get to that, though, the power of a symbol. Last week, Los Angeles officials unveiled a logo to accompany their bid against Rome, Paris, and Budapest to host the 2024 Summer Olympics. ABC News reporter Leanne Suter reacted excitedly to the design.
That new logo centers around what makes LA famous, what it is so well known for, sunshine. It shows a soaring figure illuminated and lifted by the rays of the sun.
Reactions swiftly followed. Some online commenters called it beautiful and graceful, while others said it makes them think of a Disney fairy or a Lisa Frank sticker from the 90s. The LA 2024 logo has been received relatively calmly, however, compared with some logo launches. In New York just last week, there was an outcry at the redesign of the mark for the Met. You may also remember the fuss about the makeover of the marks for Gap or Tropicana Orange Juice or the Google and Yahoo logo changes. Now, there's one graphic designer who knows quite a bit about controversy surrounding logos.
Hi, I'm Michael Barut. I'm a graphic designer who works at a firm called Pentagram in New York City. I was asked about a year ago to help the Hillary Clinton campaign to develop a logo that would be used. It's the one that everyone recognizes now with the H and the arrow.
That design, done pro bono by Michael Barut, caused an outcry when it appeared. Critics argued it was too corporate and too bland. In a cartoon in The New Yorker, one observer says, I'm just not entirely sure a big red arrow pointing right is the best logo for a Democratic candidate. Others disagreed, though, finding the logo young, modern, colourful, and most importantly, in our multi-platform, multi-screen era, flexible. So how did the designer himself feel about that response?
I was actually quite disoriented by it and surprised. We worked hard on it, and I was proud of it, and we collaborated with a lot of people within the campaign and up to including the candidate. But I said all along that this is just a device that was like, like a signature or just like a mark you would put on things just to identify the source. But, I just kind of like learned once again that these days, this once esoteric profession, this trade, this craft that I practice is no longer something that is baffling to people, but it's something that people are increasingly curious about.
It's amazing how branding gets people going.
I mean, what pleased me about it secretly was that people were able to take it as their own, and there's tons of enthusiastic supporters out there who have drawn it by hand, woven it into outrageous sweaters, painted it on their fingernails, done things like that. And of course, as happens in a campaign where people have strong feelings either way, there are many people who have turned it upside down, inverted it, made, kind of ghastly patterns out of it. You know, it functions exactly the way a symbol is meant to. You know, it's drawing someone's likeness with their nose and their eyes and their mouth and their hair is difficult, you know, and describing a big idea it can be difficult and complex. And what these sort of logos do when they work well is they really become the placeholder for much larger ideas. So the criticism that you get all the time, and I've gotten not just for that mark, but for others that I've done, is, oh, my five-year-old could draw that. And I actually love that because five-year-olds can draw peace signs. They can draw hearts. They can draw smiley faces. You know, five-year-olds can draw the simplest logos. They can't draw complex company logos because they have curves and shapes and overlapping things and highlights and modeling and sparkles and things. But, you know, a simple thing that just is 90-degree angles, 45-degree angles, two primary colors, you know, we were trying to do something that kind of felt as simple as a flag in a way. You could cut it out of paper in a minute and do it. And so to the degree that geometry looks corporate to people, maybe yes, but to the degree that simplicity was meant to be the watchword, I think we were trying to decorporatize it to a certain degree.
That was Michael Beerwoot, graphic designer and partner at Pentagram. He's the author of a new book, How to Use Graphic Design to Sell Things, Explain Things, Make Things Look Better, Make People Laugh, Make People Cry, and, every once in a while, Change the World. And we'll be doing more stories on design relating to the presidential campaign in the coming weeks. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Coming up in a moment, what makes a house a piece of art? DNA's Avishai Artsy takes us deep inside the Sheets Goldstein residence. First up, though, the Academy Awards are coming this Sunday, and most of the buzz has been around the above-the-line nominations and the concerns at lack of diversity. But what about the fantastic visuals in so many of the movies and those nominees? Today we're going to take a look at costume design, which is one of the few aspects of movie magic that you can experience in the flesh. Because right now, costumes from every one of the nominated movies in the Best Costume category are on display, along with other costumes, at the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising, also known as FIDM, in downtown. That's in their annual show called The Art of Motion Picture Costume Design. Kevin Jones is the school's curator and costume historian.
These are not reproductions or student work, since we are a school, but these are the actual costumes that were worn by the various movie stars in the nominated films.
And let's talk about those. We're talking here five movies: Carol, Cinderella, The Revenant, The Danish Girl, and Mad Max Fury Road.
Yes.
And four designers, because one of the designers has been nominated twice, and that
isn't
is Sandy.
Isn't that unusual?
Yes. Yes. Sandy Powell, she's nominated for Carol, she's nominated for Cinderella. And then we have Jacqueline West for The Revenant, Paco Delgado for The Danish Girl, and we have Jenny Beavan for Mad Max Fury Road. To the extent there's lack of diversity, we have three Brits, Sandy Powell twice and Jenny Beavan,
who have each won multiple Academy Awards for Best Costume Design. So they are very well versed in their craft.
And coming from the land that does love to produce costume dramas, as we call them. Do you think England's a kind of breeding ground for costume designers?
Oh, absolutely. Especially for, you know, the wonderful period dramas. What really threw me off, though, was that Jenny Beavan did Mad Max. I never in a million years would have thought of her as a design choice for those costumes. But then, you know, why not?
She got her start working for Merchant Ivory.
Yeah.
Famed from Room with a View.
Yeah.
But tell us about her clothing for Mad Max, for anyone that might not have seen the movie.
Okay, well, you know, the first one came out more than 30 years ago, had a very specific look, very 1980s, and I know that she wanted to get away from that kind of set idea for Mad Max and bring it into the 21st century. These are very modern day, very aggressive looking individuals. She's working with new technologies of special effects that were not available, you know, 30 years ago, such as the green screens or the green bodysuits that could be used that suddenly, you know, eliminate a body part. You think of Charlize Theron and she's missing part of her arm. And Jenny Beavan has incorporated costume elements into the wardrobe along with the special effects teams that was all done after the fact, but it creates a unified total look for Charlize Theron's character, but in a way that you couldn't have done 20 years, 30 years ago.
So let's go to The Danish Girl, and the designer there is Paco Delgado.
Yes.
Danish Girl, that's an interesting challenge, of course.
Very. Eddie Redmayne really, you know, he's a man at the beginning, and you see as his character is taking on women's clothing, there is an awkwardness about it because it's almost like a man wearing dresses. But as you slowly see his character morph and the personality take on the feminine identity, the clothing themselves becomes much softer, much more feminine, much more believable as simply this is a woman wearing a woman's garment. And it's all that transformation solely through the costumes that Paco Delgado has been able to work out.
So tell us about The Revenant and Jacqueline West.
What I find really interesting, I've known Jacqueline West for years. We've had a lot of her costumes in the past. She has been nominated before. And what I always see is Jacqueline West. And what I mean by that is every movie she does is very different. But she brings herself to the movie. And all great costume designers do this. Even though each of the projects is very different, the designer should never be lost in it. They need to also keep themselves into their productions. Jackie West likes to work with native cultures. So she's used a lot of fur, which could be very problematic in acquiring unusual furs that may be endangered, that are not easily obtainable. But she has worked with so many cultures and the way the cultures treat furs and feathers and shell work and quill work and the types of handling of materials in ways that are not commonplace every day. I'm going to go to a sewing machine and sew up this costume. Instead, by respecting the traditions and the techniques and the uses of these materials and bringing that to the screen, she really has brought a lot of that to the costumes that Leonardo DiCaprio wears, because it is, he's had to find them off of the land.
So interesting. So let's talk about Sandy then, Sandy Powell. So how would you characterize Cinderella and then Carol?
Cinderella is definitely fantasy. You know, Sandy has had to be very cognizant because we're talking a Disney film. Everybody knows Cinderella. So Cinderella does have the very large fairy tale-like blue, you know, evening gown that she goes to the ball. We all recognize it. But outside of that, everything else can be a fantasy world. It can be coming out of Sandy's imagination, and she doesn't need to stick to, you know, a formula. In the reverse, you have Carol. That is a very serious drama, completely removed from the fantasy world. It is a period film, and it was shot to look like 1950s films. And when I was watching it, I was amazed. I thought, this is so beautifully filmed and so beautifully designed, both the sets and the costumes and everything works so beautifully together that I truly feel like I'm watching an old film, where I felt I was looking at people wearing clothing, not costumes. And that is a really fine line.
We can do it, we can do it, we can do it.
That was Kevin Jones. He's curator and costume historian at the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising. I'm Frances Anderton, and you're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, we'll hear from the costume designer who is competing against herself.
Hurry, 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 gonna help our Cinderella. We've got no time to dilly dally. We got to get them all.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Back with DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Sandy Powell is a costume designer who was nominated in the Academy Awards Best Costume Design category for two films, Carol and Cinderella, both, by the way, featuring the actress Cate Blanchett. Sandy Powell designs for film and theatre, and she got her start in movies working for avant-garde filmmakers Derek Jarman and Sally Potter. She works regularly with Martin Scorsese and Todd Haynes, who's director of Carol. She was recently in town and she came by the station. Of course, the first question I had to ask her was, how does it feel to be competing against herself?
Of course, it was incredibly exciting and thrilling to receive two nominations. And then you sort of think, oh, no, it's actually going to be quite difficult. It's quite a tricky one, really. I could just split the vote and have an even less of a chance of winning. But I don't know. We're okay. Not in it for the winning, are we? We're in it to compete. In it for the, I know, the joy of being part of the group.
Well, congratulations. And the films are Carol and Cinderella. Tell us, if you will, about Carol and how that process started, creating the look for Carol.
Well, again, this started with conversations with Todd and with Kate also about the character. And the character of Carol is, she has money. She's middle class. She comes from a sort of fairly conservative background, if you like, her husband and his family, yet can afford good clothes and fashionable clothes. And I wanted her to look sophisticated and elegant, and we wanted a sort of restrained look.
And she's a sort of tortured character as well. So how does one use clothing to express that?
I don't really know. I don't, I know it sounds strange, but I don't think about it that deeply. I don't think about every aspect of her emotions. You know, I don't think, okay, she's feeling like this today, therefore she's wearing the dress with the sleeves that are this length or the collar that is this. I mean, it basically came up with a wardrobe of clothes that worked with her character, that suited her physically and looked good. And I think it just comes from there. I tend to work instinctively as opposed to intellectually, if you like.
So Cinderella, we have the gorgeous Lily James. Tell us about dressing her up in her marvellous blue.
Well, Cinderella, of course, was completely different from Carol. I mean, it couldn't be more different, really. It's not set in a real place in a real time, although we sort of had to find some basis, somewhere to set it. So I kind of suggested that it was all over the 19th century with bits of 18th century thrown in, which I call, it's sort of once upon a time period, if you like. And the reason for choosing 19th century, there are two reasons, really. One, that I knew we needed to get a big ball gown. And so the silhouette for the mid-19th century is with crinolines. And so, it would allow me to have volume in a dress. And the same with all of the ball gowns in the ball scene. And equally, the 19th century is a very good period for men. And I thought, you know, we had to take as much care over the men as the women in this film. And the men, it's a nice silhouette for the men.
And then you have the stepmother and the so-called ugly sisters, for whom you've gone for a rather different aesthetic.
The idea behind the ugly sisters is they're not actually ugly on the outside, they're ugly on the inside. So they think they're gorgeous. And of course, they were incredibly fun to do. And the stepmother, and the look for them came from, really, it started with thinking about the stepmother's character. For some reason, the idea of Joan Crawford came into my mind. Joan Crawford playing the wicked woman in something or other. Joan Crawford, Margaret Lockwood, and Marlene Dietrich. And then thinking of those actresses in 1940s films set in the 19th century. And when you look at that, when you look at 19th century period dramas made in the 1940s, they still look like 1940s with the big shoulders and the pointy bosoms. That sort of almost a femme fatale baddie. You know, I wanted her to look, again, sophisticated, elegant, but so much so that it was intimidating and a bit scary. You know, like how sometimes super well-dressed people are terrifying.
Carol.
That's what I wanted. Oh, no, Carol's not terrifying. Carol's well-dressed, but not terrifying. Stepmother is meant to be terrifying.
Both parts, we should add, played by Cate Blanchett. Having observed your work over the years, it would seem that perhaps that's your approach to, in many of your films, which is a wonderful mashup. I don't see you doing straight period. You have a way of being always that little bit more punk. Is that fair to say?
That's nice, actually. I like that. Do you know where that came from? I think that came from my very, very early days when I first started. The first director I worked with, Derek Jarman. And the first film I ever did was Caravaggio, which, of course, is about the 17th century painter. But the film wasn't set in the 17th century at all, even though there are little bits of it that have period-looking costume in it. And I didn't question that at the time. I mean, Derek set it in a sort of weird, maybe 1940s world. And his references were the Italian neorealists. And I never questioned that. And then following that, we did Edward II, which was set in 13-something or other, originally the play. But again, that was all over the place. That was whatever felt right for the character. And somehow it worked. Somehow it all blended together. And it could be a hot mess doing something like that with a different period for each character. But that kind of worked. And I think that was sort of ingrained in me. And I liked that aesthetic. I liked the aesthetic of doing what is correct for the character or the scene or the film, rather than be sort of absolutely historically accurate and doing museum pieces.
Let's go back to the start of your career, because obviously getting started with Derek Jarman is quite a way to... You start your career with a bang, and as I understand it, that was you left college in order to go work with Derek Jarman. Is that correct?
Not entirely. No, I left college to go and work with Lindsay Kemp.
Oh, my goodness.
Who was the choreographer and dancer who worked with David Bowie. And I only heard about Lindsay Kemp because I was the huge Bowie fan, you know, from the age of 12. Heard about Lindsay Kemp, who was the choreographer who worked with him on Ziggy Stardust. Then when I was about 15, 16, went to see Lindsay Kemp in London, performing at the Roundhouse, a show called Flowers, which was a legendary piece of fantastical theatre, and the likes of which I'd ever seen anything. I'd seen nothing like that in my life before. And that moment changed my life. I thought, this is the world I want to be in.
That was Sandy Powell, costume designer, nominated for an Academy Award for Best Costume Designer for Carol and Cinderella. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Last week, LACMA announced it's received a big gift, a house in the slopes above Beverly Hills, designed by John Lautner. He's the architect who got his start in LA working for Frank Lloyd Wright and went on to design astounding homes that helped seal LA's reputation as a laboratory for experimental houses. The Sheets Goldstein residence was built in the early 60s for an artist, Helen Sheets, and her husband, Paul, a university professor. It changed hands and ultimately was bought by James Goldstein in 1972. He worked extensively with John Lautner to restore and adapt the house. DNA producer Avishai Artsy toured the house last week and met its owner. Hi, Avishai.
Hey, Frances.
So this is a stunning house that very few people get a chance to get inside. How was it?
You know, it was really remarkable. I'd never been to any of John Lautner's homes, and I'd seen this house in The Big Lebowski. You know, it's a Jackie Treehorn's house where the dude shows up, and it is really stunning. First, you go through this concrete and wood sidewalk with tropical plants kind of jutting in and out. And you feel like you're sort of both inside and outside a house. You have to walk over a fish pond and there are like stepping stones to get into the living room. And then once you're there, it's this big vaulted concrete ceiling with little skylights inside. So you have sunbeams coming through. And it really feels almost like a sacred space, like a cathedral-like space.
Now, there's a film director called Betty Jane Cohen who made a film about Lautner's work called The Spirit in Architecture. We actually reached out to her to find out how he accomplished that almost sacred feeling.
He put drinking glasses in the ceiling, so they're circular, and so light is reflected from the ceiling. And so his idea was to get like a perforated light like you get in a primeval forest.
So that was Betty Jane Cohen. And when I was at the house, I spoke to Michael Govan, the director of LACMA, and I asked him what he finds so compelling about this house.
There's something about the fact that when you come into the house, you're brought into this very small, low ceiling, narrow walk, beautifully designed. You hear the sound of water, some fish in the pond, glass. And then as you emerge, the whole house opens up like a clamshell and sends your eye to the view of Los Angeles. And on a clear day, it's not clear today, not only do you see downtown, but you can see the ocean and all the way to Catalina. And that just simple gesture of that opening to the outside, and that there's no barrier because Jim Goldstein made sure that the glass has no mullions in it, is so exciting.
Okay, so Michael Govan referred to details like the glass without mullions that were added by the current owner, and that is James Goldstein. Now, James Goldstein, he's a colourful character and he's quite elusive. One doesn't often get a chance to meet him, but you actually got a chance to talk to him. So tell us about James Goldstein.
Right, and I'd only seen James Goldstein in, watching basketball. He's always sitting courtside. He's known as the number one NBA fan because he goes to more than 100 games a year. He is, like you said, a very colourful character. This guy, he's somewhere in his 70s. He dresses in a very sort of flamboyant fashion. When I met him, he was wearing a snakeskin cowboy hat, a turquoise jacket with a matching bandana, leather pants with zippers running up and down them, and leather boots. He is very wealthy, made his money on property investments, and he loves cavorting with celebrities or pictures of him with supermodels and musicians all over the house.
So how much of what will be given to LACMA is the original house, and how much was added by James Goldstein?
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to tell where the original house begins, where Goldstein's additions to it ends, because he's been working on it for 35 years. And he actually brought Lautner back in 1979 to work with him on it. And they worked together for 15 years until Lautner died in 1994. And then he continued working with Duncan Nicholson, who had worked in Lautner's office for, you know, years after that. And he's continuing to add to it throughout. I asked James Goldstein what the house was like when he first bought it. And it's a lot different than it looks now. So here's what he told me.
Well, the house suffered in several ways. First of all, it suffered from the fact that it was built with a very tight budget, and as a result, cheap materials were used throughout the house. It was primarily a plaster and formica house with very little concrete, and the subsequent owners, of which there were two more, made the house even worse. They obviously didn't understand it. They put in green shag carpets wall to wall, painted the concrete that did exist. The living room was a combination of green, white, and black. So things like that made the house really suffer from what its potential existed at the time that I bought it.
His bedroom is crazy. I mean, you have a hot tub with a retracting wood cover. You have a closet with a dry cleaner track, so his coats rotate, and he has a lot of coats. And then you have this entertainment complex that he's continually building. So he calls it Club James. You go into what looks like an underground concrete bunker, and there you have these cocktail tables made of concrete and stainless steel. You have this cantilever DJ booth that comes out next to a giant black and white framed portrait of James Goldstein. He's building a tennis court on the roof of Club James. And then he also has office space and space for his two assistants that work there.
And he also installed a James Twell Sky Space. You can also lie in his splendid triangular bed and press a button and the glass wall disappears and there's LA. It's all terribly seductive.
I mean, you have to imagine this is like a perfect party spot. I mean, it's where Rihanna recently celebrated her 27th birthday. They have a lot of fancy events there, and that's kind of what LACMA wants to continue doing. I mean, James Goldstein is going to be living in the house until he dies, but LACMA is able to use it now and plans to use it in much the same way that it is currently used for commercial purposes, for filming and fashion shoots, for private events. But they'll also have tours for the public. I mean, it'll be limited because it's, you know, a neighborhood where people live. But it will give us a chance to actually go and see this house for ourselves.
Which will be fantastic. Now, I wonder if once James has passed on, whether they'll preserve the bathroom that has all the photos of him with the 6 foot babes. Not sure about that.
I mean, you have to wonder, because even the guest rooms also have these huge framed photographs of him with these naked supermodels. You know, I mean, clearly he's lived a very exciting life. But how much of that is the John Lautner house that LACMA wants us to see as a piece of art, and how much of it is really kind of James Goldstein's bachelor pad?
Well, Avishai Artsy, thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
So earlier in the segment, we mentioned Betty Jane Cohen's documentary, Spirit in Architecture. She filmed John Lautner at the Sheets Goldstein residence some 28 years ago, and this is how he described that spirit in architecture.
In architecture, it's an extremely subtle kind of thing where you have to design, whether it's angular or curved or whatever, the proportions at a certain point with a certain juxtaposition, they have a spirit, they have a feeling, they have a life. For instance, in a church, a big classical church, the high, long nave sometimes has a spirit and sometimes it doesn't. And that's a proportion.
That's it for today's DNA. The show is produced by Avishai Artsy. It was mixed by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNA blog and follow us on our Facebook page at kcrwdna. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening.